My general view is that if you want to do good, do what you do best.
Hey Zahid, so good to see you after a long time.
Hey Ravnar, good to see you.
Yeah, it's been, I think it could be at least a good 5 years. I think it was probably before a pandemic when we actually last saw each other in person.
That's right, BC, before COVID.
Yes.
Time ago.
It's like these, I sometimes call them like the lost years. However long you think it was, you have to add on 2 or 3 extra years.
Right, yeah. You know?
So,
but you look exactly the same. So,
well done. Thank you. And you, the ever youthful face you have. It's been great, actually. It's been really great seeing through COVID because we did a lot of stuff together. You were very active in so many ways, but I was really happy to see throughout COVID you adapted really well and you were still very active and you were doing lots of events, obviously more online. It's been really great to see what you're doing, carry on and come from strength to strength. I learned a lot from working with you guys. So in the sense of the importance of bringing together different types of people across those traditional divides. So obviously you have a passion of engaging business for social impact, but you bring together academics, you know, government people, NGOs, business people. And one of the biggest things that stood out to me from the events that you put on is you really encourage people to connect beyond the job title, you know, to turn up as humans. Mm. And I mean, now that's maybe people are coming around to that, but I feel like you guys were early on in that kind of trying to see each other as humans first, regardless of how impressive or, you know, not impressive, whatever way we like to think of it, our job titles might be. And also that you love to bring in arts and culture and creativity into the events as well. I never forget in Oxford, one of the events we worked on together where you wanted obviously feedback from the delegates, but the back page of the booklet was they would write their feedback and then turn it into a paper airplane. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And then everybody had to throw the paper airplanes at the stage. And it was such it was such a great moment. So what led you, I guess, to starting Business Fights Poverty, which is obviously your organization? Mm. I had a quick look. You started out as a, looks like a kind of a finance guy, or I don't know, PwC and the treasury and stuff. So what's your journey?
So I think, well, first of all, to that moment when we last met, the paper aeroplanes, I think for quite a while before that, we were quite, I suppose, technical. You know, we'd sort of try and solve problems by technical knowledge and insight.
Data.
And we spent quite a few data, yeah. And I think we realized for various reasons that actually, if you want to drive change, insights is a necessary but insufficient part of a story.
Yeah.
And the other part is relationships and trust. And you need both of those things really to drive change. And so we over the years, have become much more intentional in thinking about how you drive trust-based relationships and human connection. And so by the time we did that event with the paper aeroplanes, we were thinking about what techniques could you use to get people to take their mask off and just come as human beings.
Yeah.
And what's amazing about what we try and do, which is collaboration, is that people collaborate better when they collaborate as themselves rather than as their title or their organization. So we tried to carry that through even during the pandemic and up to now, but it also makes it much more fun and interesting to do what we do. And I suppose going back to your question around, you know, our origin story, I suppose, you know, we really sort of felt if your mission is to fight poverty and to make the world a better place, then there's really a powerful opportunity to harness business. And we felt that at the time, so it's going back 20 years now, actually, that there was a real opportunity to think through what that means in practice. Now, how do you harness business to fight poverty? What even is poverty? And actually, what is even is business?
Yeah.
And what is the role that business can play? And we were finding at the time, so this is going back to sort of 2005, 2006, there were pockets of interest all over the place. You know, one person in Oxfam, one person in Unilever, one person in the government. And when we first started, we thought, let's try and join these dots and connect these people and think through this together. And so that was the origin. We had, I think, 3 people in the original network.
Wow.
And there was Yvette, Yvette's my wife and co-founder, as you know.
Yeah.
And so it was her, me, and one other guy. And now we have over 30,000 people.
But, that's incredible.
But and it's just, that's what really inspires us to keep going, is just that community. And as I say, you know, it's really leaning into that community to find new ways to collaborate and connect and do things together. Yeah, so it's been quite a journey, actually. We've evolved a lot as you know, over the years. It's been a fun ride.
What was the moment where you sort of stepped from, let's say, the more traditional jobs that you had? I often talk to people who've come into the space of social impact, and you know, often they do start in quite traditional roles. And I feel like often that's actually quite a strength because, you know, if you want to be a binary about it, you often have people who really care about doing good stuff, but they don't really know much about business or they're not very good with money. And then you have people who are very good with money and sort of very businesslike and maybe don't care as much about the social impact stuff. So I feel like in order to be a good operator in this space, you kind of need to be good at both, ideally, and having experience and really understanding where people are coming from the different types of players helps you in that. Like you're almost like a kind of a translator of worlds in a way, aren't you? So coming from, you know, obviously a financial background, and then obviously I think you worked for DFID, you know, international development and stuff. You've learned those worlds to some extent that you're then, in terms of the people you're dealing with later, would that be fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, I think my general view is that if you want to do good, do what you do best. So that might mean you're a finance person or a communications person.
You know,
you're better off honing a skill and then using that skill to do good.
Yes.
And we have the same message for business. You know, philanthropy is great and important, but actually if you can do business in a way that is both commercially successful for you as a business, but also has social impact, that's a sweet spot, because then you get scale and impact and sustainability and so on. So it's the same message, just do good by doing what you do best. And I think for me, I mean, it's interesting that you sort of think of me as a finance guy, because actually my father would have loved to hear that description. But actually, I to be honest, I went into university. I originally wanted to be an artist, actually. I'm just going back away now.
Okay.
And then I realized it's, you know, if you look at artists, most of the successful ones are dead. So the chance of being successful and alive is...
It's not very good,
quite difficult. Not very good odds. So I thought, okay, I'll do economics. But I promised myself I would never be an economist.
Okay.
My dad was an accountant, so I said, I definitely want to be an accountant.
Yeah.
So anyway, it all went wrong because I ended up being an economist for an accountancy firm. And then went to work for two ministries of finance, one in Guyana and then the British Treasury. But I was always really passionate about the social side, actually, even from the early days, because I actually did a gap year before university with an organization called Project Trust, where I was a teacher in Zimbabwe for a year.
Wow.
And then I did a placement year during my degree in Bangladesh. Mm. And then I went to work in Guyana for 2 years after my master's.
Mm.
So I've always had this sort of passion, I guess, in social impact. But I came to the view, sort of early 2000s, that actually, if I really want to have an impact, then there is, as I say, something here with the business side of things. Is if you can bring an enterprise lens.
Yeah.
To thinking through these solutions, and that was really powerful. And then meanwhile, in parallel, Yvette, my wife, she had been working in large companies for nearly 10 years. And that's where we brought our worlds together of business and development. And I haven't looked back now.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
I haven't looked back since.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that, because in the world of sustainability, often people think of, you know, environmental sustainability and all of those, you know, obviously very important things. But equally, if you're a for-profit organization or even a social enterprise, being profitable is part of sustainability too, because if you don't make money, you can't continue to exist and you can't continue to do good. So it's equally important, right, to be profitable so that you can do whatever it is that you want to do in terms of impact. And I love as well seeing the importance of bringing in business, because for those of us who are in the world of social impact, whether it's, you know, conscious capitalism or social enterprise or B Corp or whatever different communities are, it's easy to think that it's way bigger than it is because everyone you know and talk to is talking about it. But actually, it's kind of like, you know, one of these Pixar movies where they kind of live in a valley and they think that's the whole world. And then you peer over the mountain ridge and it's like this huge world where it's not the norm at all, you know. And it's the big world of business. And I think your hunch is right that when we, and it's slowly starting to happen, which is encouraging, when all businesses, big or small, start to think in new ways around their role in the world and how they operate and all of those things, then I think some of these things that lots of us have held dear for many years can sort of grow up, if you like, almost.
Yeah. And you mentioned B Corp there. I mean, we're both, your organization and ours, were early B Corps.
Yes.
Yeah. Right from the very beginning, actually.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting about the B Corp movement, which has itself grown massively in that period.
Yeah.
I think we became a B Corp in 2015.
So same. I think it was the first batch. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Founding
B Corps. Oh, geez.
Yeah. But to have seen that movement grown has been fantastic, because it does speak to this idea of combining business and social impact. I think the broader point, though, is that when I speak to people, in my experience, everyone wants to make a difference in the world in some way, whether it's with their family or their community or more broadly. And what's interesting is people think that to do that, you need to go and work for a charity or a government or academia. But actually, what I say to people is, actually, if you are in a company, whether you're an entrepreneur or working for a large multinational, you know, there is an amazing amount of good you can do through the products and services you create, the jobs you create, obviously the taxes you pay. Mm-hmm. That actually, business is an amazing platform to do good. And so you can be a social impact professional, even if that's not in your job title. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's probably even better. And that's one of the challenges now, actually, is moving social impact beyond our valley and making it mainstream as an idea, and getting people to realize that actually this is something you can do in any job that you do.
Yeah, 100%. It's kind of like, it reminds me, you probably know, when I was in my 20s, I became a monk. And another great thing that is happening now is people are sort of able to learn about the principles, and you know, now people are incorporating things like meditation and yoga into their lives. You don't have to go away and become a monk, you can actually incorporate it. And I remember, funnily enough, George Harrison of the Beatles was quite interested in the same tradition that I was involved in the early 70s, and he actually even thought about, because it's quite appealing, like, oh, imagine if I went away and became a monk, I could, all my problems would go away. You could think like that, right? And actually the teacher said to him, no, he said, you're much better situated right where you are. Just carry on as you are, but, you know, incorporate these things into your life.
Yeah.
And it's a similar idea. I think sometimes we can get into the yo-yo, you know, the pendulum of, and one of my uncles is a private equity guy, and he would always joke whenever he would see me, and he'd go, oh yeah, I'm a really bad capitalist, you know, and you're such a good guy, you know. And it's that kind of polarity that I feel isn't helpful in some ways, because it sort of puts people into camps. And I think the more we can, and as you say, the true person behind whichever bucket they're in is not like that. They're probably, like you say, a bit of both. So I loved what you were saying about it happened to me recently. I was on a training program, and they threw us into these groups to try and do a presentation. And it's kind of a leadership program, so it wasn't really about the presentation. It was about how we work together as a group. And one of the people suddenly took a real lead, and they were saying all the right words. It was about climate change was what we had to present. And it was all, you couldn't argue with the words, but they just felt empty. You know how there's jargon and, you know, they're talking about islands of coherence and this and that and the other. And I was thinking, what you're saying is not wrong, but we need to, as a group, let's try and go deeper and try and figure out what this really means to us individually, so that when we speak, the words might not be as clever, but they're felt, they're real, they're grounded.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we can get kind of, especially in companies or in more corporate settings, it's all about kind of how the words we use and the way we talk about it, but it's not always grounded in the personal and the human and the felt. And I think that's often a lot more powerful, has a bigger impact, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's maybe where we've gone wrong as a, call it a community or an industry or a sector. We have lent on a lot of jargon, which has been quite alienating, I think, in its effect. And actually this speaks to a broader challenge, I think, that we face right now, which is the narrative, the broader narrative has been captured by quite demagogic sort of language, you know, language of the other, of fear, of simple solutions, you know all that sort of stuff. And, you know, that's across the world. That's, you know, it's a sea in many forms. And I really think that we need to recapture the broader narrative. There's a great book, if your listeners haven't read it yet, by Jacinda Ardern, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, where she talks about kindness, not as a source of weakness, but as a source of strength. And this idea that leading with empathy is a conscious choice, even when it's difficult. And we just had our Global Goals Summit as part of the UN General Assembly Week. I opened with this thought that actually kindness is a source of competitive advantage for business, because it drives trust and engagement with employees and innovation and creativity. And actually, in the context of a world where we have so many different overlapping challenges, the need for agility and flexibility comes from kindness. And that really is a source of strength. It's not a soft skill, it's a hard edge. And I think we need to, while we tell our individual stories, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that actually we're losing the broader,
the bigger narrative.
And I think, and what that means is for wherever you are in your, wherever you work in a company or wherever you work, actually, whatever your job is, actually, if we can recognize our central humanity and recognize the idea of kindness and put it back into whatever we do, then you don't sort of have this dichotomy of you work, make money here and you do good there. Or I'll make my money, then I'll do good. It's just the way you live your life and the way you do business. So rather than the 1% of profits you give away, what about the 99% of the revenue that you generate?
It's almost like moving to a way of being, isn't it? Rather than sort of on the mental level or on the doing level, it's kind of trying to integrate it all, which I guess is the bigger journey of life. It's sort of almost becoming consistent in the way we are across all of the ways we are, if you know what I mean, whether it's in business or, you know, sort of an expression of the principles we want to see in the world, in a way, almost in how we do everything, ideally. It's interesting, the idea of kindness, because I'm on a journey at the minute around, I'm doing this leadership training, and it's all about becoming more embodied and more kind of grounded in some of these ideas. Because I think with kindness, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about a kind of a grounded kindness, like a mature kind of kindness. But I think sometimes there's also a sentimental kindness. There's different ways of seeing it. You know what I mean? And I think perhaps people who want to dismiss it would look to think of it in that way, like it's a sort of a, it's not a very grounded and strong thing. It's a kind of a flopping in the wind kind of thing. You know what I mean? And so there's also work for us to do to have that principle, but also to really become very grounded in how we live it, if you know what I mean.
And I think it's, you know, I think when we look at the current debate, the pushback on the woke agenda, as it's labeled, actually, if you were to speak to people across the political spectrum, I think as we were saying earlier, if you get to people's humanity, we all care about actually quite similar stuff, whether it's for our kids or for our communities or whatever it might be. We just need the right stories that make us feel that we're on that same journey together and not on perhaps, you know, different, opposite trajectories. It's a real challenge. I mean, I don't know how we do that. I think for us, in our own journey, you know, we are now a big community, and a lot of what we try and do is surface the stories of our community members. I was listening to your last podcast around Sunny Money, and that's a great story. We've told that story a few times on our platform, but we want to surface those stories. And as we, and in a way, the pandemic pushed us further to, because of the use of online technology, everyone, there's no excuse now to not listen and surface stories from all over the world. And so we were really trying to lean into whose stories are we telling, who's telling those stories and facilitating that. And I think the more we get to see other people as humans, actually, the better. I just came back from Paraguay. So one wonderful country, visiting an organization called Fundación Paraguaya. And they've got this tool and a philosophy, in fact, which is all about people themselves defining their own situation and having agency to take action to improve their situation. And that the whole flipping the narrative of whose stories we're telling and seeing people as people, not as beneficiaries or as numbers. I think there is so much more work to do.
Definitely. And I think as well, a lot of times online, the way it kind of plays out, whether it's on YouTube or these kind of places, for want of a better word, like the minority or whoever the person is that's trying to have the voice of a particular type of person or community, it's often in a combative setting. So it's actually not ideal way to try and understand that person or their perspective better, because it's already in a polarized, heated kind of context. So as you say, we need to have more opportunities to hear from people themselves about their stories when it's not in that type of a context where they can really just tell it. Because as you say, oftentimes, like there's a huge group in the middle. There's obviously always the people at the far ends of each side, you know, and they're often the loudest. And so it's easy to mistake that for that. But there's loads of them who think like that. But actually, the vast majority of people are in the middle who, you know, maybe are informed, maybe aren't informed, maybe just haven't had experience or exposure to different types of people. So they just don't really understand or know. Yeah. So I think whenever you travel or you go places and you meet people who are different and the conversation is a normal type of conversation, then often people will come away going, oh, I didn't really realize that. Now I understand it better. I think there's a need for that. But I loved what you said. It's something that I have been talking about for a long time, is for organizations, what often happens is, because obviously our position is often helping them to tell their story, they default, understandably, because it's just such a strong default setting that's been there for such a long time, into trying to make their organization the hero of the story. And even when you have you know, you're working closely with someone and you completely agree a different course, if you don't keep pushing the opposite way, it will drift back to that by default. And so there's a really clever way around it, though, which is, I have this new phrase I've come up with, which is, you need to first of all understand your defining story and then find 100 different ways to tell the same story that don't seem like the same story, you know, but they are the same story. But the way to do that is through all of your people. So whether it's your own people, through your community people, through your staff, through your customers, you know, your beneficiaries, your partners, whoever it might be. And so indirectly, you do benefit from all of those stories, because you're the postman, you're the person bringing the story, and it's in the context of what you're doing. But you put whoever the person is that you're highlighting as the kind of the hero, that, you know, you really give them the stage. And so, yeah, it's really important, but it's not an either or. Like, you benefit massively by doing that, and so does everyone, you know. So it's an interesting.
Yeah, I love that. I guess a lot of organizations, in terms of their objectives for storytelling, might be fundraising or awareness or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I think one of the challenges for us as a community is, how do we tell a better story globally that addresses and shifts the narrative that seems to be taking hold? And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you're the comms professional. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how do we recapture that narrative?
It's interesting. I've thought about it quite a bit, because there's a danger in... because obviously the polarizing ideas do catch attention. And, you know, I find by nature, I'm kind of feeling like I want to create balance and show perspectives from both sides. And then you become a centrist, which is a kind of a, maybe a fair position, but it's a very difficult position to tell a strong story from, because it's kind of almost just becomes all balanced out. There's no tension. You know what I mean? And I was just reading something yesterday about, what's his name? The Reform UK guy, Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage, yeah.
And someone was just commenting that he doesn't, and this is apparently like an ex-Tory minister, was saying he's a populist, like he's like a chameleon. So he doesn't really have like that much solid ideas about stuff. But he does know how to capture, to tell a good story and to capture people's minds. So like a lot of his pictures up until now have always, you know, been with a cigarette or with a pint of beer or whatever. So he's kind of mirroring to the audience that he wants to attract. And apparently the thing that kind of, I guess, tipped them over the edge to say this was, now he's going on dressed like a farmer, because obviously the farmers are striking. So he's kind of very clever. And I think one of the challenges that our kind of community faces to capture that kind of imagination is, and this is not a solution, but it's an observation, is like, we want to play by the rules. So in a game where you want to play by the rules, then you're agreeing to be called out if you stop playing by the rules and you go, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't play by the rules. But a lot of the other people are going, we're not playing by the rules, so you can call us out as much as you like. We just don't care. That you can't win against that because you're thinking like, no, this is not right. There's rules and you're not playing by the rules. And they're like, yeah, but we just don't care. So it's very difficult situation.
Very difficult. Yeah. I mean, populists and demagogues, I mean, by definition, they're very charismatic.
Yeah.
They rely on simple stories that give simple solutions to complex problems, typically by blaming other people or offering things that they know they don't have to fund. That's the finance point. And I think they also undermine trust in facts and in reason even. Mm. And so actually, I think from our side, I agree, that we tend to play by the rules, but also we tend to argue based on facts and a sense of what is true.
Yeah.
And if you undermine trust in sources of truth and facts, in experts, in the establishment, or whatever wording you want to use, it's very difficult to win an argument when it's not fact-based. I think that for us as a community, I mean, obviously we need to hold on to our sense of what true is. And actually, that's one role of communities like ours, is to call out the gaslighting that seems to be going on at the moment.
Mm.
And to say that these things matter and this is what the situation actually is.
Mm.
But in how we communicate and broaden appeal around themes like kindness and so on, you know, there I wonder whether the storytelling needs to be more emotional and in language that's more relatable.
Definitely.
Than we've used so far.
I think one of the things that they understand is that to reach that broad audience, it has to feel... There's a great guy called Donald Miller who has a company called StoryBrand. And his whole thing is the best product doesn't win. The clearest explanation of it wins. Because, and it's also a thing like now, it's increasingly the case online. Another person that I've learned a lot from, Daniel Priestley, I think you may know him as well. He says like, a lot of us are of the view that we write an article or a blog or whatever and we don't want to be kind of those loud, noisy people or shouty people. So we just put it out once and people will see it and they'll read it and whatever. But he's saying like, no, actually, it probably takes about 30 pieces of content for people to even notice you. They haven't engaged yet. They don't know what you do yet, but they've just gone, oh, that person's popped up a bunch of times. They've even like mentally noticed you. And now that they've noticed you, if it's something that's connected to them, it probably takes another whole bunch of stuff for them to actually start to, like a jigsaw almost, start to put pieces together. So it could be actually quite a long time till they actually go, oh, I get it. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, like even people that know me and that have been around, you know, me for a long time and probably seen us doing so many things and talked about so many times, they still don't fully quite get what you do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of amazing. It's just a sort of a reality. People are so busy. There's so much stuff going on. Maybe it doesn't fit cleanly into one box that it's easy for them to get. So there is definitely an argument to be made for simplifying, at least in the beginning. So one of the things I often love saying to people when we're sort of starting to work together, I think it's an Oscar Wilde quote, like, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I just didn't have time. So it's like, it actually takes a lot more effort to condense something down. It's easy to just waffle on and talk and, you know, so.
Yes.
So actually to do that discipline of condensing it so that it's clear and easy to understand. And of course, there's so much more depth. You know, I think people in our thing are like, yeah, but it's more complicated than that. There's so many aspects to it. It's so nuanced. And you're like, yes, all of that's true. But that is not, you can't lead with that. You need to have people come in the front door first. So that's probably a massive one, is to simplify. It's not to dumb down, but it's to simplify the messaging and also consistency in terms of communication, but also in terms of values and how you show up. I think that's one of the huge strengths to your community is you're there, you're always there. It's the consistency. That's how you also build sort of trust. Even when times are hard, like so I said, the pandemic was difficult, right, for everybody. It was like a whole new way. Mm. But you still showed up, you found a different way to keep supporting that community. And so that's a type of communication as well, if you know what I mean, in and of itself.
Yeah. And if I think about the populists, they're very good at the strap lines and being consistent around their strap lines.
And repeating them over and over and over.
And repeating them over and over again. I mean, interesting, just looking at the election yesterday in the US, where there was cut through in by Mamdani in New York. Mm. He had one message around basically cost of living and just said it over and over again. And I think the irony of the world that we operate in, which is about essentially fighting poverty, we're not speaking necessarily clearly directly to people's own sense of well-being and their own livelihoods and resilience. All the issues that people face, whether it's access to healthcare or energy or whatever it might be. Somehow the irony of our work on social impact is we're not connecting to people well enough around their own social situation.
Yeah. And that's something that you've done really well in your convenings, but how could we do that at scale? You know, get people to connect in a more human way. And I think sometimes you do need to, you know, so if you think of the hierarchy of needs, we know it's a triangle. So the further down you go, the broader it gets, right? It's maybe, you know, I don't know if I'm putting myself in the camp as well, so I'm not criticizing, but I think sometimes we kind of think, you know, lofty ideas and sort of theories of change and all these kind of things. But maybe we just need to come down the hierarchy of needs a bit to meet people a bit more at a simpler level initially, you know, to kind of connect. Because if you think of kindness as an operating system, like if you were creating a new human or a robot or whatever, and you were programming it, what would you put in there? Okay, well, you'd put in this, this. I think you definitely want to have kindness, right? It's kind of like, it's sort of trying to think of it almost in that simple, basic way. How does kindness serve us all, you know? It's not just about like the others or, you know, the people who need it because they're weak and everything. No, each and every one of us, it creates a better world for sure. It's an very important ingredient. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's a live issue. If you think about AI and the conversations around what should be programmed into AI.
Yes.
I imagine most people would want kindness in AI and some sense of fairness.
Yeah.
You wouldn't program it to be divisive or to not use facts. I mean,
unless you had a different agenda, of course. Like, so this is
unless you have a different agenda.
One of my friends says, it's not whether AI will become conscious or not. It's what is the consciousness of the people who are creating AI. So it depends where they're coming from. But I think on that point, though, there's always two sides to everything. A lot of people come to dislike how saccharine, nicey AI is to you, because you know you say it does something and you say, oh no, you did it wrong, I want it like this, and they go, oh yes, you're so right, what a great insight and all this, and you're just like, shut up. You know what I mean? And so there's I can't remember what it's called, I think it's absolute mode or something. You can ask it to go into a different mode where it just, it doesn't do any of that and it just talks to you much more matter of fact. So I guess it plays to the point I was making earlier. Of course we want kindness, but nobody wants, you know, that sort of almost toxic kind of fake niceness. You know what I mean? Mm. And that's where all of these concepts kind of, it's not like they are outside of us. Like I was going to say, they need to grow up, but we need to grow up in how we, you know, mature in what these concepts mean in a kind of a grown-up way, not just a kind of an idealist way, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's why when I was speaking at our UN General Assembly event, for me, we have to be clear that kindness is a hard edge and has some really robust elements to it that give us strength. And I think one of the reasons it's important is that it's about building trust. And to do that, it has to be authentic. So
100%.
It's not the sort of fake kindness or the smile, that sort of thing. It's actually how our values align with how we behave across our lives and in the way we treat people. I think just be nicer to people. I think the strength of humankind is in being kind to other humans. It's in the name. It's
humankind. You know, it's,
Yeah.
But one of the things I admired about you both is, you know, when we first started working together, you talked about wanting to up your game in different ways. And that time it was about, you know, using more video and stuff. But I also saw that you had coaches and, you know, you really invest in yourselves like as well to try and sort of, if we want to be better, then we kind of have to be better, if you know what I mean. And I guess there's also a piece around that for, I don't think you can work this stuff out. You can, to a certain degree, work it out intellectually, but it has to then sort of become embodied in some way. You know what I mean? Like more towards the heart and sort of into the being. And I think oftentimes if we see in our own experiences, and maybe as we go through life, we see other people not being kind to other people, it's often because we are not accepting and loving ourselves. Now, this might sound kind of, but you know, that kind of inner, I don't want to say hatred, but you know what I mean? That kind of like where we're just so hard on ourselves because we think, you know, whatever, and maybe it's wherever that's come from. And then we are like that with other people too. So, we're, you know, there's a sort of, for it to move beyond, you kind of have to accept your own humanity in its own faults too, and accept that we're, to be human means we're not perfect. And therefore you can sort of give people a bit of space because, you know, when you've accepted that, but as long as you're sort of bashing yourself and not sort of accepting that part of yourself, it's very difficult to accept it in others too.
Yeah. No, that's a very profound thought. I think, to be kind, you have to start by being kind to yourself.
Yeah.
And I think one of the sort of silver linings of the pandemic was a much greater awareness of mental health issues and the fact that, I think especially I find it in the social impact sector, people, they push themselves because they know that if they don't do that extra hour or day, that in some way they're failing on their mission to do more good in the world. And so they don't spend enough time thinking about themselves and investing in their own health and well-being. And that can be very uncomfortable, actually. Yeah. So that journey to the paper airplane moment was a very uncomfortable moment for me as well. Because the coach that I had at the time, who was fantastic, said, you've got to get on stage. Stop like being behind in the backstage crew. Yeah. Get on stage and talk about your own story. And so that was quite a transformative moment for us as well, just sort of coming to terms with that. Because we have all the same insecurities and doubts and
of course,
and so on that I'm sure many people have. But you just could do it anyway. And so it was a interesting moment, really.
Yeah, I remember that. And you were nervous. Like it was a new thing.
Very nervous.
But that's, I guess, part of the, you know, I admire that you put yourself through it, because whenever we are going to try and grow, sometimes that middle bit is super uncomfortable, like really uncomfortable. But equally, on the other side of it is growth. And now, I mean, I can even just tell by the way you're speaking to me now, and I, you know, I can imagine you, doing your address. I bet it's. It might be still a little bit nerve-wracking, but you're a lot more comfortable doing it now, right?
I think the hard thing, and what we try and encourage all of our community members to think about, is just come as yourself. I mean, even within our team, you know, I've got an amazing team, and some of them were very nervous about moderating sessions and stuff. And I said, no, actually, people want to see a human being being authentic and just do it as you.
Yes.
And what that does is it encourages them to come themselves. And the nice outcome of all that, if everyone comes as themselves and you create collaborations and partnerships as yourself, like in a marriage, actually, or in any formal relationship, it's a much stronger relationship as a result. There's no effort going into the pretense or the mask. It's a hard thing for individually for people to be happy with coming as themselves.
Yes.
They much rather be, I'm the amazing title, that's an amazing brand.
Yes.
And some hiding behind that to some extent. But actually, it's much more fulfilling if you just, and actually much less stressful, just be yourself.
And weirdly, the audience, it will land better with the audience, you know, because, you know, it sort of links really nicely back into that point of accepting ourselves. It's kind of like, oh no, but if I was just me, that wouldn't be good enough. Well, ironically, it's actually, it's better because everyone's waiting for an excuse for someone to give them permission to just be yourself. Oh, I can relax.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we ask everybody, I have memories of being in New York with you guys, and you had a room where all the SDGs, you had them all printed out, and people were taking photos and getting videoed of the different ones that they loved. So you obviously, and you set up challenges where you bring different organizations together around specific SDGs. So you're well-versed and immersed in the SDGs. But I ask everybody to choose one, which perhaps was hard. That just kind of means something a bit extra to them for whatever reason. So if you'd be happy to share that with us.
Yeah, so I guess it wouldn't be a surprise that I would choose the SDG 17 on collaboration and partnership. The thing that I suppose I spent my entire career thinking about is how do we do that better? Why do people collaborate? How do you do it better? So we've really worked on our version of what we think works. In fact, we call it purposeful collaboration in our world. And it's really just doing that, being very purposeful and intentional in why you're collaborating, who you're collaborating with, also who you're not collaborating with, what you're going to do together, by when, and doing it in a very authentic, co-creative way. I do find that typical approaches to partnership and collaboration end up with big offices and complex structures and huge budgets. When actually, if we just come together as ourselves to move a needle on things we both, you know, we all care about, then that's a great form of collaboration. And it's, you know, much more organic and fluid. And I think with one thing we want to do better as an organization, which I think we've done quite a good job since, I'd say, the pandemic, in bringing more voices to our events. But I think in terms of how we collaborate and come together in all sorts of other ways, I think we can do a much better job in bringing voices into that. So that's an ongoing, that's a work in progress for sure.
One question would be, I know it was when we were working together before, it was a kind of an aspect of partnership that can be difficult, is if everyone comes as themselves, and obviously they can connect and have something meaningful, but they're still operating in the context of their organization. So it's kind of like, what are the kind of challenges around them as an individual getting excited about something, and then whether they can implement or not in their broader context? And then I suppose on the flip side is, you know, if they're coming more from their organizational perspective, then how do you get people to collaborate when maybe it, to whatever degree it does or doesn't fully fit with what their organization wants? So it's kind of like in the moment, I'm imagining, you know, there's a lot of energy and kind of collaboration and ideas, but then when you bring it out more into action, I guess some of those tensions are, you know, things to navigate.
Yeah. In fact, the latest publication of our Business Facts Poverty Institute was sort of on that question. The report was called Five Bridges to 2045. Oh, nice. 2045, by the way, because that's another 15 years beyond the SDGs. We'd also be another 20 years older if we make it that far.
Okay.
The bridges are very practical ways that we think you can do the sort of things that you were just describing. So the first bridge is around building bridges inside of organizations, so between different siloed teams that typically exist in most companies and across organizations. So that's the bridge between the, say, the social impact teams and the finance team or the procurement team. So those bridges are so important because up to now, social impact has been the preserve of a social impact people.
Yes.
They have it in their title or in their team name or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So that bridge beyond social impact, I think, is so important. The second one is between issues. So social and environment, for example. We've tended to, we've tended to focus on the social, but have recognized, and we have an event actually coming up shortly around that sort of social dimension of climate change and climate action, because it is all about people and the impact it has on people. And then it's about these bridges vertically from the sort of board level down to the, well, right across the organization, bridges between those who are making decisions and those who are impacted, so the people proximate to the issues we were talking about. And the final one is bridges between organizations that maybe traditionally don't partner together. So I think there are examples of that working in practice. Yeah. And in the spirit of our community, a lot of what we do is about surfacing learning, knowledge about what works and what doesn't work and helping move things forward. And we think those bridges offer a way to think through how you turn a personal passion coming to yourself into something that's more systemic in its impact.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that sounds really good. I think that's the way, isn't it? I was just with an educational schools trust the other day, and they were talking about how could they bring in more Church of England schools. And that was my similar point. Like, do you have any Church of England schools already? Yes, we do. And they came into the trust. Yes. So let them tell their story. Immediately from letting them tell their story, those who are like them will see their journey, and they'll have had the same challenges and concerns and worries and whatever. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense to showcase the examples of people who've actually walked that same path to encourage others to do it.
And we had an interesting case, which I learned a lot from, where we had what we call peer circles, but basically we bring people together in these safe spaces online or in person. And it was looking at climate justice was the topic. So a social equity lens on climate. And we had people from within this one company, from all the different departments. So it was the social team, the climate team, but also people in like bits of the business that have nothing to do with this in their day job. And I was thinking, I suppose I went in thinking, this is going to be interesting, but actually, how useful is this going to be? All the best ideas came from people who were not in the social team. Because actually, going back to our original point, when people came as humans, they're all thinking about these issues in their life. Yeah. And we're already thinking about how they could apply what they know, their core skill, their experience, to making a difference. And I think if you can just create that space, that's a safe space for people to come as themselves and bring what they have to the table.
Yeah.
It's actually easier than it might seem. People want to build bridges almost by default. I think as a human nature, actually, people are bridge builders.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't forget that.
How did those people in that scenario from the other departments get chosen? Did they self-select, like it was offered out, or how? Because that's an interesting thing. Because even though they're in the other departments, if they, for whatever reason, have an interest or care about the topic, then they are already a bridge in a way, because they're in a different group, but they're also invisibly in this group as well, if you know what I mean.
I've seen some lots of interesting models. I think in many cases there'll be like champions identified for an issue across the organization, and obviously that's great having those message carriers and so on to broaden the story and also bring insights from those departments into how these issues are thought about, especially if you want to embed this into a core of a business and go beyond philanthropy. In this particular case, the one I was talking about, an invite was sent out and someone was nominated. So whether it was voluntary or not, I don't know. But I guess the fact they turned up.
They
voted a bit with their feet. So I think you probably do need to go a bit with where the energy is flowing. But I suppose the takeaway that I had from all of that is actually there are pockets of energy everywhere. That's really what Business Facts Property is about. It's about connecting those points of energy to create something bigger and more ambitious and brighter.
Yeah, amazing. It's interesting. It's kind of like one of the very first things we talked about. I was fascinated to hear that some of those best ideas came from people outside of the typical, you know, people that are thinking about this, because that's our blind spot, I think, sometimes as people who are in it. And it goes back to what we talked about, different types of people in society. We think in a certain way. Everyone thinks in a certain way. And so therefore, it's hard for us to understand how someone who thinks differently thinks differently. But when people come together in a spirit of collaboration, then their difference is actually the strength, if you know what I mean. Sometimes we want to try and make everyone the same. We don't actually realize that actually, no, it's a good thing that we're different. You know,
it brings
different perspectives, different strengths, you know?
Yeah. It's one of the ironies and hard truths of the social impact world is we're not very diverse in any metric, actually, but including in the way we think. It's probably been, like you said, the blind spot. That has probably been one of the causes of where we are now, actually, is we haven't listened well enough or
open enough, perhaps.
Been open enough.
It's funny, you know, I had, just because I didn't want to presume at all, when I asked you about your SDG, I had no idea what you were going to say until a couple of seconds before, and I went, oh yeah, of course, the partnerships. But what's fascinating about this is no matter who, not everybody, but a lot of people I've spoken to have sort of identified that whatever one they choose, they are so interconnected. Like, so somebody talked about, obviously, Richard from SolarAid, about energy And he was saying, like, it kind of underpins a lot of the other ones. If you don't have energy or light, it's difficult to do education, skills and employment, etc. Someone else was talking about gender equality. There's half the picture is missing if we don't, you know, look at that. Education. So it's fascinating how interconnected they are. You know, even though obviously they're presented as separate, they all have so much. And another mind-blowing statistic, I think girls' education is something like, has the potential to have the fourth biggest impact on climate change. Now, most people would think, well, what's the connection, you know? But, you know, it's fascinating.
I should say, I think that is one of the challenges from a communications perspective as well and the storytelling side, because it's that, you know, that old adage, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yes.
And, you know, you have a microfinance person and that's their solution that they're going to bring to the community, or it could be access to energy or education, whatever it might be. And I think too often, and maybe even the dominant view now, is quite external. It's that we are going to go and help this community, in some sense, save this community. And this is my shiny thing that I'm going to save it with. And it might be microfinance, whatever it is. And I think what's interesting about going back to my trip to Paraguay is the methodology that they've developed, which they call the poverty stoplight, is actually saying, well, actually, let's enable everyone to define what their priorities are and what their strategies are. And then let's come behind that, because actually they do a lot of microfinance, but they were finding that that wasn't necessarily translating into improved lives for the people they were helping. But when they pivoted into asking people, how would your life improve? Then other things that they weren't expecting came out as priorities. And I think, and this model, I think, can be applied, you know, across companies and across societies, across all sorts of countries as well. If we start with the person, the human in mind, and not presume what the solution is, then I think we could make much, much more progress on these issues.
It's a very interesting thing, isn't it? The power dynamic, because we can often think that there are things that we may not be aware of, in even if we're trying to do it in a good way. You know, like, for example, as you say, if you go in and you're a funder or you whoever you are, it's kind of not stopping to think that the people you're engaging with, even if they it looks like it's all collaborative, because you're coming as a funder, naturally, they're going to be talking to you in a certain way because they want the funding, or you know, so they may not be telling you really all the thing, you know, what what it is. So if you come in and, like, as you say, I've heard this more recently, it's encouraging in a very different way. And so it's kind of back to the point of, like, let's put the performative stuff out of the way and let's really, like, hear from you 100%. Imagine if there's nothing on the line, you're not going to gain or lose anything. Let's just genuinely try and understand and then support what makes most sense on having understood that. And yeah, that's a much more powerful solution. But it's like if you have a child or a teenager or something, you know, and you ask them something, they're thinking, well, should I tell them the full truth or not the truth? And it's like, and you're frustrated because you're like, no, I want to help you. Just tell me. But there's something not quite being said, right? Because of the dynamics of who, how they see, you know, if you tell a funder everything, they may not fund you, for example. So that's
the challenge is, if we focus on humans and humanity, humans are very complex. And poverty is not one thing. It's not income. It's multidimensional. How do you tell that complex story? That's the hard thing, with that single, clear, pithy.
Well, I just had an idea as you were just in the last 5 minutes. There was a great, I interviewed him actually on my previous podcast, The Evolving Door, a guy called Jonas Sachs, and he had a company called Free Range. And they did an animation. It was quite long. It was like 50 minutes or something, but it had such a charm to it. At the time, it was hugely successful. It was called The Story of Stuff. I don't know if you've seen it. If you don't, have you haven't?
I have heard it.
It was brilliant. And so we really broke down it in our conversation why it was successful. And he expressed kind of frustration because it was so successful. But then everyone just was, we want The Story of Stuff for what we do. He was really honest. He explained, like, it was a multitude of factors that came together in a very sort of fortuitous way that enabled it to be like that. And part of it was that the lady, I think her name was Annie, had been talking about this stuff for a long time. So she was really comfortable and had a really a brilliant way of doing it. So her voice, it's a voiceover, but it's not like a traditional voiceover. Mm. It's like a story, like, you know, and it's long, but they did this beautiful animation and they got like funding to do it and, you know, the whole thing. But that was quite a long time ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, maybe even more. So I'm kind of thinking of a story of stuff type thing that addresses, it's long enough that you can kind of tell lots of mini stories that kind of weave together and kind of join back up later on and you make the connections. And so you're kind of telling what seems like a simple story, lots of simple stories that add up to a kind of a much bigger story that you kind of go, So like the kind of things that we're just saying about, you know, on one hand, it needs to be simple, but it's not simple. In one hand, you could go in thinking it's this, but actually it's also this. You know what I mean? And I think that would probably sum up what so many of us are experiencing and thinking in a way where when it's something's effective like that, it's like that. You know, sometimes people in the comments, they just put a finger and they go, that. You know, like that kind of sums it up, you know. If we could get some funding to do something like that, we could do it.
Yeah, that's right. It's going back to the AI point. I think when you think about AI and what you get back when you ask a question and what it's trained on, generally the stories that are fed into it are all very positive about, aren't we amazing? This is what worked. Mm. This was the impact of what we did. The thing that's missing often in AI and just generally actually maybe even in our events is the stories of what doesn't work and how actually difficult success is. It's not a straight line. It's a complex, squiggly line to get from one place to another. Mm. And that's where the humans come in, actually, and where we never be defeated by by AI, because you need that human experience of what works and what doesn't work. And I think the storytelling also needs to be, I think, honestly grounded in how difficult this is.
And brutally honest sometimes, I think, because with that same schools trust, I was explaining that I feel like you need to let that school tell their story, but you have to lead with all of their reasons why they thought it wouldn't work and why they were, all of their fears and concerns and worries, because that's how you get the trust with the other organization who goes, yeah, that's exactly what we're thinking. And then obviously you can come to how they gave it a try and actually it was okay and it wasn't as bad as they thought and they overcame them in this way and so on. So you can arrive at a good place. But unless you, it's like everybody says, oh, just buy my app and magically you'll just press a button and like you'll have 500 pieces of content. You want to believe it. I mean, you really want to believe it. But of course it's not that simple, you know? So we kind of were biased towards, like just kind of like, you know, the great fuzzy feeling at the end. But like, you're right, the where the trust is gained is in sharing like the proper stuff that in the back of our minds we know is there, but maybe no one wants to talk about.
And maybe that's enough of it, is how can we build trust through storytelling? Because if we can build trust, we build relationships, and if we build relationships, which, as I say, combined with the insights of what works and what doesn't, then we can drive change. But that trust is really the missing
ingredient. And it's a huge currency, because if you trust someone, then you're willing to listen to what they have to say. Like they don't have to knock it out of the park every time. You know, you can sort of be sitting with someone if you trust them and you can see that they're kind of trying to find their way to the thing, but you give them that little bit of space to do that because there's trust. So we're coming closer to a human reality, whereas a lot of, you know, marketing or, you know, the marketing type stuff is like one of your team members on stage trying to be a presenter, whereas trust is where they can go, no, I can just be myself. It's almost earning the right to have a more honest conversations with each other and to give, you know, rather than having to, okay, come on, impress me. You know what I mean? You know?
Yeah,
but I always ask as well, I hope you've had a chance to think about something. Is there a campaign or a piece of content that you have seen over the years that you loved or you thought was great?
There's actually a few that stick with me. One is a South African one called No Excuse by Carlin Black Label, which was a campaign against gender-based violence.
Okay.
And they had this amazing campaign around the bridal dress, if you Google that.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
And essentially, a bridal dress is made up of... of components that protect women from the different types of abuse they might face. A very, very powerful campaign. it was powerful not just for its messaging and imagery, but also because it spoke to the core of the brand and the reach that that brand could have, including to perpetrators as well as to survivors.
Yes.
And I think it was very bold of a company to leverage their brand and the reach to have such a hard-hitting and important message. So that really, we had this, the person behind it speak a few years ago at one of the events, and people were in tears by the end. Just the story of how they created it and then watching it, it was quite powerful.
Amazing.
Another one, and because I have, as you know, I've got two daughters.
Yes.
And so I think a lot about their futures. But there was one campaign by Always called Like a Girl, and it was sort of challenging gender stereotypes of what that means and turning it on its head and saying, as a source of strength, this is what being a girl means. So again, they were authentic to their brand. They use their reach. The execution was brilliant of it, because they had young people sort of voicing the stories. Maybe a final one I mention, we had a big program during COVID in East Africa, including lots of companies, but one of the companies involved was Unilever. And through their brand Lifebuoy, they had a campaign called H is for Hand Washing, which I thought was brilliant. You know, sometimes you sort of hear things and think, I wish I thought of that.
Yeah.
Brilliant and obvious when you look back on it. But they had this whole campaign around the importance of hand washing and tackling COVID.
Yes.
But more broadly, improving health outcomes. It was just a masterful stroke of using the best of marketing and comms to take a very complex idea and make it relatable and actionable for people. And that really struck with me. So yeah, quite a few examples I've seen where they're clever, they're authentic, and they really cut through.
No, I'll check those out. I'll put the links as well to those in the show notes for people if they want to watch them.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting in all of them, again, if some of the things we talked about during the episode is like they connected with people on a human level. There's a sort of a very simple idea at the heart of each one, you know, probably a singular idea. And that's the beauty spot, isn't it? Where it does match with the brand, but it also has this huge social impact. It doesn't feel like a bolt-on. It also doesn't feel like a shoehorn in. You know, it's that spot when you can get it where it feels right for both. And I think sometimes brands try it, and if it's a little bit off, it can, and I guess that's why brands might be scared, you know, it can, they can get a lot of backlash sometimes if they don't get it quite right. A fascinating one on the Always one, I think I've seen the campaign, but or maybe a different one, similar. It was a big thing that I realized, obviously, you know, I did that big documentary called A Girl Can Touch the Sky on gender equality and education in India.
Yeah, which is brilliant, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it was, thank you. Yeah. And it was something that, particularly from the first trip, like in the second trip we did, we were much more intentional. We went and spent a lot of time with communities and families. But on the first trip we did, where I was doing the tuk-tuk adventure, we were just stopping and talking to people wherever we could along the way and asking them about these topics. And you got people saying, and I think it's in society too, oh, but we have like goddesses that we worship in the temple. And so there's either the goddess on one end, right, where it's like putting, you know, them up on a huge pedestal, women. And then on the other end, you know, we talked earlier about the pendulum. There's kind of like, yeah, but if they go out and they're on their own or whatever, then they're just seen as street girls almost, you know. What about this huge part in the middle where they're not goddesses and they're not street girls. They're just ordinary women, you know, like let's come to terms about what we think about that. Cause that's the majority, right? We can go, oh, they're so amazing or they're so terrible. No, like it's almost humanizing the, what it means to be a man or a woman. You know, you don't have to be a goddess. And you don't have to be the worst of the worst if you're not perfect at every moment. And I don't know if the Always one did it, but I saw one where, you know, it was talking about a woman was saying like something that sounds a bit crude, but like, you know, we do fart. And it was kind of like, just kind of like, because it's kind of like, oh, no, don't talk about that. No, you know. So it's kind of like just humanizing, like, let's just kind of relax a bit and like, we deserve to be respected and accepted just for being ordinary women. you know? And I think that it's a theme that we've gone through a whole conversation about, kind of just learning to accept ourselves and others just for who they are, as they are, you know?
Yeah, I think those two extremes that you've mentioned, I think they're both elements of the patriarchy. They come together. And often the pedestal is a bit of a warning. But I think what was interesting about the Always campaign, I think they asked young boys, what, run like a girl.
Okay.
And so they film what they look like. And then they asked the girl, run like a girl. And they went full out.
Yeah.
And my youngest is a sprinter. So I
can really relate to her. Yeah.
Very, very fast.
Yeah.
And so a lot of what it means to be human is such a learnt set of beliefs and cultural norms that we almost have to unlearn.
Yeah.
Because you're not born with those.
No, I don't think so.
Cultures, but it baked into you quite early on. So it's we have to do a lot of unlearning really as well to be able to come together.
As
humans as well.
Well, lovely to chat again. You're, if you'll allow me to say, you're a lovely human.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And where can people find what you're doing? Because obviously there's lots of amazing things you're doing. You convene events. There's ways for people to actually get involved and become part of the community. You're always publishing different reports and insights. So much good stuff. So how do people come across some of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, find me on LinkedIn or go to businessfightspoverty.org. And there's lots of ways to engage. And this is a thing where the more of us, the better, really, because we all bring a little bit of a solution.
Yeah.
We're always keen to connect.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you, Ravenel.